How many of you would like to hear a sermon that was actually given in the Bible, instruction in the Bible, where it tells us that the sermon was given for those who live at the end of the age? Now, that's quite something. When you read that, there's actually a scripture that says that. Now, even though it was 2,000 years ago when this came from God, inspired by God to be in the scripture, it still says for the end of the age. And to me, that means that there's probably going to be more problems with whatever is mentioned, whatever I go into today from God's word at the end of the age than maybe at other times. Although we do know Sodom and Gomorrah was a really horrible period of time spiritually, and so it was at the time of Noah. Notice one of the girls here liked Noah. But anyway, this sermon actually also that we find concerning the end of the age also ties directly to the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. That's why I found it very interesting. So we're going to go there today. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 11 is where we're starting. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 11. And here it tells us, now all these things happened. Now, this chapter, you can tell, is before the Passover chapter, because 1 Corinthians 11 is concerning, at least part of it is concerning, the instruction on taking the Passover. So we have the chapter before, and also Paul is writing to the Corinthians probably during the unleavened bread season. The Passover had already been taken, so when he wrote this, he had heard from, was it the house of Chloe who was writing in there? And they gave him they tattletaled, I guess you would say, in a right way. And so he was instructing them, and according to 1 Corinthians 5, it says, as you are, it seems to be as you are now keeping the feast. But whatever the case, we'll pick it up here in verse 11. Now all these things happened, and we're going to go back to those things. All these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, on whom the end of the ages have come. Now, I suppose from God's standpoint of view, since he inspired this, and Paul didn't know when the end would come, he perhaps thought, from what we read in other places, that the end was going to be fairly soon. But from God's standpoint of view, if you look at eternity, then you look at 6,000 years, and then you look at 4,000 years passing, 2,000 years is the last part of a race, so to speak. Because you get into a 600-meter race, the last 200, that's the last part. And that's what we're dealing with here. So we have the end of the ages, and we definitely are closer to the end of the age than the Apostle Paul. So for sure, this does apply to us. And whatever we're going to talk about today are examples for us. God knows we need it for sure. So he goes on to say, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. And he says, no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. So I would ask the question here, what temptation could cause us to fall? Because really, we're going to be taking a look at temptations. They're a part of what Paul is talking about. But temptations that cause us to fall. And we're going to go back to the time of Israel and take some examples from them on what not to do, but we'll have to pay particular attention to the temptations that came. But first of all, let's go back to verse 1 of chapter 10, 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 1. Moreover, brethren, I don't want you to be unaware. Now, when God inspired him to introduce this, we need to take and listen closely, because he says, I don't want you to be unaware. It's important that we are aware, is what he's saying. I want you to be aware that all of our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, and were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. When I was going over this again last night, I said, well, Marian, how could they have been baptized if there was just water on their right and water on their left? And it's like, well, and I said, now, I'm just asking you because I just read it more closely for the first time in my short life. God would consider it a short life for sure. And what I noticed here is that they were under the cloud and all passed through the sea. It's quite interesting. They were under the cloud. Now, the cloud led them by day also. We do know that. We understand. But all were baptized into Moses, not into John the Baptist, not into repentance, but into Moses. So Moses was going to be the deliverer, and they were going to be the disciples. They were going to be the students of Moses. They would be delivered, not by Christ literally here in the sense that they, the one they can see. Now, God definitely would be the deliverer. That was my sermon on the first day of unleavened bread, that God is the one that delivers. But what we see here is they were baptized into Moses and they had a cloud over their head and there was water around them. So they were baptized. And it was symbolic, of course. All ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. So there's a type here, definitely. Moses, we know, was a type of Jesus Christ himself. God was delivering them. Even though God said, Moses, you know, these people that you brought out, you remember that. Nevertheless, God is the one who delivered them. But there was something spiritual going on here. What God wants us to understand is not just that, well, they came through the sea, and then they ate manna, and then they drank water. It was a spiritual intervention, is what he's trying to say, that God was very much involved. And what he's going to lead to at the end of this is that if they want God to be involved in their life, if that is the Corinthians and us, then we need to take note of what the Israelites did wrong, because we can certainly be caught up in this. So this was spiritual. It definitely was intervention by God. It was spiritual when the Red Sea opened up. There's no doubt about that. A cloud following them by day. And it says follow. It's interesting. It does say follow, but they were following it, I hope. And manna, that was spiritual intervention. And then a river of water coming out of rock. I think I've mentioned this before, but we don't want to forget it wasn't just a tiny little trickle of water where you have 10 Israelites, you know, lined up like the movies might show. Although some of the movies have, you know, the huge numbers coming out. I understand that. But from the Psalms, it says water like a river came out. So when you put it all together, it was massive. And they should have been able to look at this and say, God is very much involved. They had the 10 plagues. So they should have recognized tremendous power, tremendous spiritual intervention, and it should have influenced them. Should have. Now, I really think that we would be impressed. Although if you see a movie, how long does it take to be unimpressed from a movie? But if you actually went through it and the armies were chasing you and you saw the armies swallowed up in the sea, That would be with you a few days, and I would think a few months, and I would think a few years. I still remember just trying to parallel the account in a small way. When we were in Corpus Christi, we could not get in. I was directing the feast that year, 86 or 87, whatever it was. But we could not get into the parking lot. I've told the story before, you may remember. Just couldn't because they had the Corpus Christi Fiesta, you know, for the whole city. There were lights down on the Broadway there next to the beach. It was a huge deal. They had set up all their little stands and all, and they weren't going to leave there till 9 o'clock. And they, all the town was coming in. This was their last night. This would be the big night. All the parking spaces were taken. So we sent a letter out asking for prayer that God would open things up. And it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and you look out over the inlet there, basically, and you see this huge black cloud coming in, rolling in right toward the fiesta itself. As 4 o'clock, you get some light rain by 5 o'clock. You get a heavier rain at 5:30, and you get a washout at 6. The feast was supposed to start at 7:30, I think we were starting. And everybody was cleared out of that lot by about 7 o'clock. The whole town, the electricity actually went off. There was a lightning strike on whatever was set up as their main source of electricity that they set up temporarily, the electric company itself, and knocked it out. There was no way they could continue. So, and that stayed in our mind. You can see I'm still telling the story. And that was, again, in 1986, 87. So that'd be 28 years ago. You don't forget things like that. So God did these things, and he was hoping that at least from a physical, fearful standpoint of view, they would remember, and they would sit back, and they'd say, well, maybe we can complain. But we won't. We know God's going to deliver us, just like he did before throughout these several weeks that all of this deliverance took place. So, it was spiritual. God says this was spiritual. Remember that. This was something out of the ordinary completely and totally. And I'm delivering you. The rock that followed them was Christ. 5:5. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples. Now, this is the first time it's mentioned actually, but the second time we read it today, of course. To the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they lusted. Now, we're going to go into what I call the four temptations. Because remember, we read that no temptation has overtaken you. The temptations overtook them. But here it says, no temptation, that is, these are examples that we should not lust. Now, what we men like and what I like in preaching is a box. And the first box you get into is lust. And there's, once you get out of that verse, there's nothing else on lust. It doesn't overlap with anything else at all, because it makes for a sermon where now you have an artist that is giving, inspiring this. Men are boxes. Women are artists. They go back and forth. And guess what, guys? God is not only a man. He's called our father, but God made women too. I know that's hard to believe, but he did. But I got your attention, didn't I? The mind that women have comes from God. The creation that you see is not squares and rectangles and triangles. That'd be men's creation, although men are artistic too. I'm not trying to downplay men's gift. But what I'm just saying is there's overlap here. God is painting a mural, and he's painting, you know, a picture where you have all of these problems overlapping into the other problems, because they do. You can't take steel, for example, and say, no, steel is all by itself. None of the other commandments have anything to do with steel. No, we know there's always overlap. There's idolatry. There's covetousness, etc. So what we have here that I'm going to is four temptations of Israel in the wilderness. And what we should beware of in this end time, because God says this is for the end of the age. Okay, so let's take a look now. The one in general is, do not lust after evil, verse 6. When I looked up this word, I thought I would find the word lust, and I didn't. I just found, you know, evil. It's evil that it's focusing on here. Do not go after evil, basically. Do not involve yourself in evil. That's where it's going. And now it brings up after verse 6, and by the way, they lusted. They did lust. So let's just pause for a moment and understand what temptation is. James chapter 1 tells us the following. Let no one, in verse 13, James 1, 13, let no one say when he's tempted, I am tempted by God. God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. So it's just impossible for God to come down and tempt you. And he's not able to be tempted. But each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own lust. So all of us, he meaning mankind, I am tempted. So I put it in my perspective, I am tempted only when I'm drawn away by my own desires. So I have desires. Now I'm drawn away by them. Okay. I don't stop. I get drawn away by desires, which causes temptation. Drawn away by desires. So how do you get rid of temptation? You get rid of evil desire. And we're talking about evil here. How do you get rid of temptation? If you're drawn away by your own desires and enticed, the only way to get rid of temptation is to cut the desire short. Once you understand, once we know that it's not right, you just go like that. Otherwise, we're one step too far. And if you're like me, you know, it's like that old magnet where you're getting closer and closer and closer. There's a point where it's too late. So you've got to stop immediately. If the desire is wrong, you've got to cut it right away. It's the only way to stop temptation, because temptation is being drawn away by desire, wrong desire. Does that make sense? Now, you and I are going to be tempted. Better yet, you and I are going to desire things. How's that? We're going to desire something this week that is wrong. The desire in and of itself, the thought, probably is from Satan because he's the tempter, isn't he? But it becomes our desire. Now, it could be our desire. I'm not saying it isn't. It could be either. It could be a thought from Satan the devil, or it could be something that we have from association. And once we recognize by the conviction of God's Spirit that it's wrong, we just cut it short. And then you're enticed. You have that desire. You're enticed. And desire conceives. It gives birth to sin. So whatever the Israelites were having a problem with here in 1 Corinthians 10, it definitely was desire that was wrong. Desire that was wrong. Okay, so what is the first one mentioned in this evil here? Verse 7. Now you might want to put a piece of paper in 1 Corinthians 10 because we will be coming back to it. And also you might put a piece of paper in Numbers because we're going to be going there too, going to be going there. So 1 Corinthians 10, notice what it says. And here are the four temptations, and I'll let you know what they are right now. You can read them, but I'll just tell you what we're going through. Number one is going to be idolatry. Idolatry. Number two is going to be sexual immorality. Number three is going to be tempting Christ. That's a good one, isn't it? That's a bad one, actually, but how do you tempt Christ? And four, murmuring. Actually, complaining. Both. Those are the four. Now, it's interesting that those are the four that are mentioned, too. When you stop to think of your own and my human nature. And this is for young and old alike, by the way. If you're too young, you have no idea what sexual immorality is because you don't have estrogen. Well, you have estrogen and you have testosterone. Makes a girl a girl and a boy a boy. And, of course, there's mixtures in both. But I didn't like girls till I was 17. Cost money. They got in your way. They were, you know, they're just not a boy. They just weren't guys. And at 17, they changed. All the girls changed. I didn't change. They changed. Because when my wife came along, before she was my wife, she all of a sudden was very attractive. But I'm just saying the little kids don't recognize, you know, anything having to do with the opposite sex. That's what I'm saying. But we in our age know that that's a problem. Idolatry, what's that going to be all about? So let's go through these. Verse 7, 1 Corinthians 10. Do not become idolaters, as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Exodus 32, and I said we'd go to Numbers, but the first place is Exodus 32. I don't think we're going to be going back there, but we can go there to the start, at the start. Exodus 32, verses 1 through 10. When the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, Exodus 32 and verse 1, they gathered together to Aaron and said, come and make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. He was gone for 40 days. It is interesting that 40 days is the number of trial. So if 40 days is the number of trial, does that tell us that God is not going to immediately come and show us the way? 40 days is that number. We have to wait. It just tells us there's a waiting period. And 40 days was a period for physical, carnal Israel. They were left with Aaron, of course, and he could have restrained them somewhat, but he didn't. So you read the story here in verse 4. He received the gold from their hand, fashioned it with engraving, made a molded calf. Then they said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. So, you know the story here, all the way through verse 10, where God said, let me take and destroy them. I will make of you a great nation. And so Moses pleaded with God and said, no, let's not do that. What are the nations about going to be thinking about you? They will say that you brought these Israelites out of Egypt just to destroy them. So let's go to verse 19 now. So it was as soon as he came near the camp that he saw the calf and the dancing. Remember, they ate, they drank, and they rose up to play. They were dancing, and no doubt they were dancing around this this image, this golden calf. So Moses became angry. He took the calf in verse 20, which they had made, burned it in the fire, ground it to powder, scattered it on the water. And then he went to Aaron, but Aaron said, you know the people, verse 22, that they're set to do evil. For they said, verse 23, make us gods. Now, what does this have to do with us? We could go on with the story, but we know the story. We realize that many died because of this. There were 3,000 that died by the swords of the Levites. What does this have to do with us? This is idolatry, okay? This is idolatry. What is idolatry with us? Let's go to Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5. Colossians 3 and verse 5. Here we read a reference to putting on and putting off. Verse 5, put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Now, we think, you know, we would never, ever use gold, silver, or for the poor, as it says in Isaiah 40, they took wood that wouldn't rot, is what it says there, and they made an image for themselves. And that's how oftentimes we think of idolatry. But what about just covetousness? If covetousness is idolatry, is that any worse than making an image and dancing around it? And the answer is no. It is idolatry. It is the worship of other gods. Idolatry is whatever you do other than placing God first in your life that you think will make you happy, and me too. That's what idolatry is. It's putting anything before God, thinking you need that to make you happy, to give you joy, to give you peace of mind, to make you a kinder, more gentle person. Now I've got what I want. Now I can be satisfied. Now I can be happy. That's what idolatry is. So what is your idol? What is my idol? This is what we have to think of in the days of unleavened bread, because we could go through and we could take a look at those dirty Israelites and we could say those were good stories and miss the whole point. So this is for us today, and we're not going to go out and make idols. I really don't think that the man of sin at the end of the age is going to have a huge statue made of himself. He'll have pictures probably. That's kind of the way it is. This Saddam Hussein and Mussolini and Adolf Hitler, you know. But probably not a big statue, a small statue, sure. Yeah, we'll give him small statues. But it won't be the same. I don't think you'll have a Nebuchadnezzar saying, fall down and worship this or else. I don't think that's the way it's going to be. But we will be committing idolatry by choosing someone that comes along that is the antipathy of God himself. So where am I covetous right now? Because we're going to see that all this is leading to the Passover and versus, let's put it this way, the Passover versus sacrificing to other gods. That's where he's leading with this story here. The Passover versus sacrifice to other gods. So what are you and I coveting? It hits us all. It's not foreign to any of us in this room. Unless, again, we're 2 years old, although I've seen two-year-olds want somebody else's rattle. You know, or one. Maybe it's one. It's been a long time since we've had kids. So that was the first one. Now, sexual immorality. Verse 8 of 1 Corinthians 10. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. When we go to the story, it says 24,000. Nevertheless, that's a lot of people. So 3,000 on this first one, 23,000 for sure on the second one. Do not commit sexual immorality as some of them did. Now that's covetousness too, which is idolatry, which could also be stealing somebody else's mate. Could be. But whatever the case, this is the second one that is mentioned. Numbers 25, 1 through 9. Let's go to the actual story. When we were down in Branson, the seminar that I gave was actually on this subject, where we're going from 1 Corinthians 10 and the example that is given, or referring to Numbers 25 exactly. Numbers 25, verses 1 through 9. So here you have the story where the Israelites are heading toward the promised land. And in verses 1 through 9, Israel remained in Acacia Grove, 25:1, with the women of Moab. They began to commit harlotry, that is, with the women of Moab. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. Now, again, the Midianite women are going, not going to come over here, and you're not going to see them next week at church. When you go home today, you're not going to have a Midianite woman. Your wife would get upset anyway. You're not going to have a Midianite woman there. So really, we're reading the story, but there's an application for us in the church, because it says for us at the end of the ages, and I don't think most of us probably, if we were given a map of the world and said, point to the area of Moab, a lot of us, many of us could, but point to that area and show me where those women came from. So really, it's not a big concern. There are other areas in the world that now have, you know, the reputation of being a bad place to go because of selling human beings, selling sex, basically. So they invited the people, verse 2, to the sacrifice of their gods. And the people ate and bowed down to their gods. Is that idolatry? So Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was amused against Israel. Then the Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people, hang the offenders before the Lord out in the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. So they went ahead and did that. But Phinehas is in the camp now, and he sees one of the Israelites take a woman into a tent very nearby. Evidently, Moses saw it. It was in the sight of Moses. He went after the men in verse 8 of Israel in the tent and thrust the man through and the woman through. So the plague was stopped among the children of Israel, and those who died were 24,000. 24,000 in that plague. God allows us as a nation to do things. God could have stopped this nation from some of the abominations that have been accepted in our society a long time ago. Could have stopped it when just one state or two states signed off on some of their abominable statutes or judgments. But he didn't. He's allowing us to just do whatever. He's given us over to, and brethren, politics isn't going to stop it. There's nothing you and I can do to stop people from breaking spiritual laws. Romans 7 says, the law is spiritual, but human beings without God's Spirit are carnal, and they're sold under sin. So when we get into politics, we are trying to intervene with people who are already sold under sin. It's like they're sold to do it. They don't want to do what is right. I think it's another example where we're going to see that they were intent on sinning. You just can't stop a nation. There's nothing absolutely that we can do. Nothing. You know, we can yell and we can scream, and we should do that probably. You know, do it before God. But people do not have God's Spirit. They don't know the way. That doesn't mean everybody's going to get involved, but the nation is going to be awfully raw by the time Christ returns. So let's remember that. So what about us? What about us? I used Revelation 2 when we were in Branson. In fact, I started with Revelation 2 because it does show that in the church, we can have this problem among us. Revelation 2, starting out in verse 12. To the angel of the church in Pergamos write, these things says he who has the sharp two-edged sword. I know your works, where you dwell. Satan's throne is there. Now, it's no excuse. There's no excuse just because Satan's throne is among us. It's no excuse if you have a satanic nation and you're around people who are following, worshiping demons. It's no excuse because they were there and God says, you have a problem. It says, you hold fast to my name. You did not deny my faith even the days in which Antipas was my faithful martyr and he was killed, where Satan dwells. But I have a few things against you because you have there those who are holding the doctrine of Balaam who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel. Can't curse him. Remember that? Balaam said to Balak, I can't curse him. I want to curse him, but God says I can't. I've tried three times now. I think it was three times. I can't. So behind the scenes, Balaam says to Balak, You want to cause Israel to stumble? You want them to maybe be stopped in their path so they do not flood over Moab? And I'll tell you what to do. You get some women over there and you invite them to your Christmas and your Easter. That'd be it. You invite them over to your pagan holidays. And now we got them. These Midianite women must have been pretty beautiful. All of them must have looked like my wife. But they were no doubt knockouts, you know, maybe Victoria's Secret types. Also, it says, taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel to eat things sacrificed to idols, which took place, we just read it in Numbers 25, and to commit sexual immorality. Now, 24,000 died. So where is that a problem? Is that a problem in our society? And the answer is, take a look at the sale of sex. Our kids don't have a chance. I wouldn't want to be a kid in high school. I wouldn't want to be. You know, the advertisements that are out there, and we have public television. We're not even on cable anymore. We were for a while. But there were five programs that we were watching on cable. So I finally said, you know, if we're all, there's only five programs anyway, and that's NBC, CBS, ABC maybe, and a couple others that were there, and I can pull in enough bad cables just locally without cables. So we have, and you can, by the way, parents, you can go through and you can knock any station out that you want. You can just get rid of them. They don't even have to come in. They won't show up. Just go up and set your channels. You can go into the channel setting and you'll never see them again at all. Kids will never see them. You won't have to worry about something coming on TV. They won't be there. Just won't. So what do we have in this society? Where does it come down to us in the church? And the answer is, anytime we see or get involved with something sexually immoral, anytime we stick with a movie or go to a movie that becomes explicit, I mean, they're there all the time. And you probably could start naming some, but the Wolf of Wall Street, was that it? Which we didn't see, but we sure read the review on it. The Wolf of, was that it? Whatever. But I understand it was horrible. But it had, you know, raving reviews from the public. Just did. And there are others out there. This is the way you would hold to the doctrine of Balaam. By doing that. And God killed 24,000 people. Now, is he upset at us if we would get involved in that? And the answer is yes. Is it idolatry? Is it sacrificing? Is that what took place first? I think there is an important lesson in the story that sacrifices and idols were first. So you stay away from that. Otherwise, at the end of the age, God is very upset with us, and what is he going to do? Do you think there's a tribulation out there? And the answer is, and I don't give hell, fire, brimstone sermons, but God says, be aware. Follow these examples. The other side of the examples. How about verse 9 of 1 Corinthians chapter 10? Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Numbers 21. Numbers 21. It's a short story, but it gets the point across. Numbers chapter 21. There's six verses here. And remember, it says in chapter 10 that they were destroyed by serpents, so we know exactly what it's talking about. How did they tempt Christ? Numbers 21, verses 1 through 6. When the king of Arad, the Canaanites, and I'm reading this to just show you that God was there with them, he did intervene, but that didn't seem to matter. When the king of Arad, the Canaanites, who dwelt in the south, heard that Israel was coming on the road to Atharim, then he fought against Israel and took some prisoners. So Israel made a vow and said, if you will deliver this people into my hand, I will utterly destroy their cities. And the Lord listened to the voice of Israel, delivered up the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them and their cities. So the name of that place was called Hormah. Then they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the soul of the people became very discouraged on the way. Now by this time, they had a lot of God's interventions, didn't they? The people spoke against God and against Moses. Now this is where Paul says they tempted Christ. So we can apply it to ourselves, or ourselves, plural. Why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? Have you ever said, why did you call me into the church? You know, people have said that. I don't know of any of you who have, but if we go to God and say, why did you call me into the church? Because they basically are being called, they are being called to go into the land of milk and honey. So if we say that, you know, we are tempting God, tempting Christ. That's what we're doing. Because he's listening to our prayer to God, and he is saying, what? Now you're tempting me. You are tempting me. I don't tempt you, but you are tempting me. Tempting me to what? Do something to make me feel good. I think during World War II, right at the start, you had a prime minister of England that actually went over to Adolf Hitler, and he appeased him, right? He appeased him. So, are we tempting Christ to appease us? You brought us into the wilderness to die, and there's no food and no water. And by the way, we detest this manna, is what they said. We detest it. So, I'm tempting you to do something about it. You ever tempted God? And it's like, well, we need to think about it. You know, you need to intervene right away, or else I'll go to another God and he might be able to help me out. Because that's where he's leading. He's leading to, we will go back to Israel. You don't give us what we want, we'll go back to Israel. Korah, where are you? You'll take us back. Or Korah, you'll get rid of Moses, right? That we want to go back. Is that tempting God? And the answer is, that's tempting God. We don't have enough. If Satan were in charge, we'd have a lot more. Is that what we're saying? And the answer is, yeah, I think so. If somebody else were in charge. So what does Satan say to God? If I were in charge, you know, let me take over. So you can see why God would take such exception to that attitude. So at the end of the age, we have to be careful. Life is going to get tougher. It's not going to get easier. And we have to be ready for it. Okay, the last one. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 10. Don't murmur, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed by the destroyer. And this takes us back to Numbers also, Numbers 13. Now notice it says they were destroyed by the destroyer. There was a lot of murmuring going on. But in this account here, it's a special time where they were destroyed by the destroyer. And it's going back to Numbers chapter 13. And here we pick up the story where Moses picks out one representative from each tribe. By the way, Caleb was from Judah. And Joshua was from Ephraim. I was reading over this last night, and I had forgotten where those two guys were from. So you have an Ephraimite and a Judahite. Now, it's interesting that the World War II, you had the British telling the Turkish people to keep the Jews out of Palestine. That's kind of a turnabout, isn't it, from this account. And it was Winston Churchill was very much involved with that. And the Pope of the Catholic, the future Pope of the Catholic Church, was the one who actually was trying to help the Jews. Of course, they had to sign off and become a Christian, some of them, to be able to be protected. That's how they did it. And then they became a son of the Pope, a son of the Father. But whatever the case, here you have Caleb and Joshua, who had the good attitudes. Now, as we go here, we see that Moses says, look, I'm sending you in to the land. I want you to tell me what the land is like. Is it fruitful? What are the people like? What are we getting into here? So, verse 25, they returned from spying out the land after 40 days. They departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh and brought back word to them, showed them all the fruit of the land. And verse 27, we went into the land, it flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, that is a statement that got them into trouble. Nevertheless, there's a lot of big people there. We can't go in. They will crush us. And what did they do? Well, they told everybody about it too. So you get to this verse 30. Caleb quieted the people because now people are doing what? Oh, no, we've come all this far. We're almost in the promised land. And we're just going to be destroyed. That's all. So Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and take possession. What's the difference between a pessimist and an optimist? If a pessimist sees a big pile of dung, it's a big pile of dung, and that's all it is, and it doesn't help them a bit. If an optimist sees a big pile of dung, they think there's a pony in there somewhere. Now with Israel, it was the other way around, really. They saw all of this fruit, all of this, the milk. They saw a land that they were about to go into, and it was about the time of the wave sheaf offering in the very near future, where they could start eating it, because you can't eat of the land until the wave sheaf offering is waved to God. And they knew that it was really great. The homes were there for them already. So, verse 31 said, no, we can't go in. They're stronger than we. And so they gave the children of Israel a bad report. Verse 1 of chapter 14, then all the congregation lifted up their voices, cried, and the people wept that night. And all of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in the wilderness. We're here and we're victims and we're going to die. Okay, so that's murmuring, right? Now, where were they headed? Just, you can answer that one. Where were they headed? They were headed to the land of milk and honey. They were going into a type of the kingdom of God. It was a kingdom of Israel, but a type of the future kingdom of God. And they were almost there. They were just right around the corner. And they could have gone in. They should have had the faith to know, because this wasn't too long after God had taken them out of Egypt, was it? It's not like 2 years had passed. It wasn't like 3 years had passed. This was just a short time ago. They crossed that desert quite quickly. Forget the number of days, but we'll figure it out. 50 days? A year maybe at the most? Let's see. They came out, and this would have been the next Pentecost season, or was it wave sheaf offering? Coming back to the wave sheaf offering? Not more than a year. Not more than a year. So it should have been indelibly stamped in their mind what God had done. And by the way, we still have all of these scriptures to read, and we can see the power of God. And when we get into trouble, when there are problems coming along, we should be able to say, God delivered Israel, God can deliver us. No difference, it's the same God. So what happens then is, verse 11, how long will these people reject me? How long will they not believe me with all the signs which I have performed among them? How long will they reject me? That's what gets you in trouble. Chapter 14, verse 11. 14 and 11. Sorry about that. So, verse 36. The men whom Moses sent to spy out the land, who returned and made all the congregation murmur against him by bringing a bad report of the land, Those very men who brought the evil report about the land died by the plague before the Lord. It kind of tells us we have to eat the Passover bread and drink the Passover drink in a right manner. Part of that manner is having faith in God, I would think. But let's go on here with the story in 1 Corinthians 10 as we begin winding up. Philippians, we know it says that Paul was content in whatever state he found himself. Are we murmuring? Are we murmuring in the church? God always delivers. God always delivers. Never fails to. Maybe not in our time, but he eventually always delivers. He just does. And what he says here in verse 13 is verse 12, let him who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall, because the temptations are going to come along. One of these temptations will. It'll be covetousness. It'll be sexual immorality. Can't get away from it. If you've got internet, iPad, iTunes, anything, maybe not iTunes, but it's going to come. My wife doesn't even have to have me come over to my computer anymore. We both use Chrome because it filters out more. But why would you use a beautiful, half-naked woman to advertise a book of the Bible? I mean, it's like, what is this? She's in a bikini. It has nothing to do with. If you have never seen this one on the Learning Spanish, you seen that one? I mean, so there's a beautiful girl there. That's going to help me learn Spanish, this advertisement of a beautiful girl. It's like, and they're not naked. I'm not saying they are, because they can only go so far on Google Chrome, probably. But still, it's like our kids don't have a chance. They don't have a chance. Take heed. No temptation has overtaken you except such as common to man. The temptation will be there because we do have desires, but it doesn't need to overtake you. God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted with murmuring. We can stop ourselves from murmuring, can't we? We don't like our kids to. We weren't allowed to murmur. We weren't allowed to complain as I grew up. You just weren't allowed to do it. You just would go to your room right away. And I can't figure out kids who will not obey you, but you tell them to go to their room and they will obey you. How's that? Have you figured that one out yet? Time out. They will do a time out, but they won't obey, you know, eat your carrots. No. Well, then you have a time out. Okay. So God will always provide a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. So you're still bearing something. It's still difficult. Still difficult. But at least you're able to bear it and not succumb to the temptation. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. So now you have this one thing here. Like I said, God paints with this brush that overlaps everything else. So flee from idolatry. So flee. Flee is one of those big words. I speak to you as wise men and women. Judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing which we bless. Now he comes back to the Passover. If we understand properly what we did at the Passover, then we will be able to keep from being tempted or falling into or succumbing to the temptation. In other words, we drank of the wine, we ate of the bread, and that told us we are going to be followers of Jesus Christ. We're going to have the mind of Jesus Christ, right? We're going to follow his example in suffering so as not to sin. We will have a lot of bearing because we have the same mind of Christ. The bread is not that the communion of the body of Christ. For we, being many, are one bread and one body. We all partake of that one bread, that is, symbolizing Christ. observe Israel after the flesh are not those who eat of the sacrifices partakers of the altar of God. What am I saying then? That an idol is anything, or what is offered to an idol is anything? No, but I say that the things with the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons. So when we are guilty of any of these four temptations, we are sacrificing to demons. That's the story you get from it. He goes on with other things here too, because now he's going to be talking about, you know, eating food. He does so in Romans, eating and doing other things that have, well, this is meat sold in a meat market. He comes down to that. So he's trying to show the difference between sacrificing to idols, being involved in idolatry, and other things that had to do with meat offered to idols. Nevertheless, what he's saying is, we do not want to sacrifice to demons. The four problems were mentioned earlier. It wasn't buying meat in a market. That was not going to be the problem. That was not one of the five temptations, brethren. And I know sometimes, you know, clean and unclean meats can be a bigger issue than murmuring. And the answer is, while we're eating clean meat, we murmur. Might as well be eating unclean meat at that point. Right? So, don't eat unclean meat. I'm not saying that don't eat unclean meat. This is going out. Okay, do not eat unclean meat. Certainly don't. But I'm saying, if we're making a big issue of one thing, then make a big issue of the weightier matters of the law too. Right? We have to do that. Murmuring must be a weightier matter. Tempting Christ is a weighty matter. Sexual immorality is a weighty matter. And so is idolatry. So as we keep these days of unleavened bread, let's go back to 1 Corinthians 5 and see what it tells us here. I know this would have been read on the first day of unleavened bread by Justin Atkins. Your glory is not good, in verse 6. Do you not know? This is 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 6. Don't you know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Therefore, purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed, Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, not with the leaven of malice and wickedness. We saw four very wicked things that we don't want to do. But with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. And this word is very sincere, and the word that we spoke today and that we read today is truth. So this is a message of the Passover and days of unleavened bread at the end of the age. I hope all of us, including myself, can learn more and more of how to be unleavened.